Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. 6 days into 2020, Game Show Network launched its first new game show of the year. Learn how Get a Clue is doing when executive producer Craig Brooks gets on board with us next from Los Angeles. Elvis Presley, if he was still alive, would be 85 years old this week. We'll explore the role TV played in the career of this entertainment mega superstar later this hour with Presley historian, expert, and author Frank D'Onofrio. Our final question today, binge or no binge? As this new year and decade begins, how do people prefer watching their favorite TV shows? Reachery Insights has some new research on the matter, and judge the results for yourself next hour when we hear Reachery head of Mean Entertainment, Nova Benoit. Also ahead, Wall Street Week returns tonight, one peacock down, and our classic trivia question of the week. Hey everyone, I'm Simon Applebaum, simulcasting live from New York on Blog Talk Radio and Spreaker, and presented on the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. This just in, tomorrow will be televised. Brought to you by Audible.com, the leading provider of spoken audio entertainment information that will transform the way you hear the world. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get free books when you sign up for a 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/televised. More details later in that hour. A very good Friday afternoon to you, and welcome once again to the program All About Television. 48 degrees at the top of the hour, getting ready for a very warm weekend. How warm, you might say, here in the Big Apple? How about near 60 degrees tomorrow and over 60 degrees, maybe near 70 on Sunday, believe it or not. We have a great show lined up for you over the next 90 minutes. We invite you to be part of the program. All it takes, a phone call from you. So raise your voice and use this number, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. The number's good anywhere you're catching us across the country and around the globe here on Blog Talk Radio and Speaker. You know, to be involved in our chat room. We have a few people already in the room right now. It's SimonApple04 by name, and you can find it on our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. And, of course, while the program is on the air, you connect others by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon on your Blog Talk or Speaker screen. Follow the instructions. Other people could be live with you. We'll have news notes for you near the bottom of the hour. But right now, joining us live from Los Angeles is Air Radio Systems, the executive producer of GSN's first original game show of this year and decade called Get a Clue, Craig Brooks. Craig, welcome. Happy New Year to you.
Hey, Happy New Year to you, Simon. Thanks for having me on.
It is a pleasure. How is Get a Clue doing first week on the air?
Yeah, I mean, the feedback I've gotten so far is that everybody seems very happy and that it's doing well. You know, I think it's just like every game show that needs to find its audience. And but yeah, we're very excited about it. And you know, GSN seems excited by the project as well. And I'm seeing Rob pop up all over the place in interviews, which is nice to see him out promoting. Just excited to see how the audience takes it.
Since you brought up Rob, let's talk about that for a second. It's Rob Belushi, and I got to ask the question, is he related to John?
He is. He's Jim Belushi's son, John Belushi's nephew. And, along with that famous name, you know, he's got a ton of talent, and it comes by it natural. And he also has a tremendous amount of, you know, improv training and experience from Second City and, you know, from performing all over, you know, touring shows. And he's also taught improv a great bit. So someone with amazing chops coming into hosting a game show, for sure.
We have somebody who just came into our chat room. Thanks for coming aboard. Put your thoughts in the room or make the call, 646-652-2906. How did Get a Clue get developed to the point where GSN decided this is going to be the first game show we're going to open our new year and decade with?
Well, I think that, you know, the idea of like a clue giving and receiving that kind of you know, that kind of a game has always been something that, I mean, there's been many different shows that have used that, you know, famously. And it's something that they haven't really done on their network. And so I think it was something that they were interested in taking it and putting their own new unique spin. And it came out of the internal development team at GSN. And so I was kind of brought on to, you know, put it on its feet, do run-throughs and develop the format further. But definitely it was, you know, those games are, it's hard not to be engaged. And I know, you know, for their viewers, one of the things that they want more than anything is that, you know, that engagement from the home audience. And those kinds of shows are, whether you're in the living room watching or you're in the kitchen making dinner, listening, you know, I know, just talking with my wife the other day, and she was had the show in the living room. My boys were watching, I have two sons, they're watching the show. And my wife is yelling at the TV from the kitchen, you know, and so that kind of engagement, that kind of fun, it's hard not to become engrossed in, you know, and so internally the show was developed, and I think there was great excitement in that the run-throughs were always just extremely fun to play along from watching.
This is an example for those who have not seen the program yet of what I call the human relay game, where you have four or five people on a team. Sometimes it's a case of the men versus the women or women versus the men. And the idea is to communicate a word, a phrase, a name, some sort of message from one player to the next player. Examples of that are shows like Go, which you can see some of the reruns on YouTube, Bruce Forsyth's Hot Streak. And way back when, there was Better Sex that pitted Bill Anderson and Sarah Purcell. What is the key to making that kind of a relay game work?
I think that ultimately, you know, like Hot Streak, you know, used one word down the line where, you know, you couldn't, you know, use the same clue. And you know, ultimately the mechanism of getting information – some of the problems, I should say, or challenges with regards to doing this kind of a show. Now, technologically, we have the benefit of having a monitor in front of a player, so we're able to deliver the word that they need, or, you know, whether it's a proper name or a word that they need to transmit to the next player down the line. So with regards to the technology, it's a little bit easier, a little bit better, because we can, you know, hide that screen from the players who are nearby, as opposed to like Hot Streak had headphones and, you know, they would take off headphones, tap on the shoulder, turn and do headphones. So it's a little bit easier in that regard that we can send words to monitors. They're basically that idea of sending, giving a new word, transmitting it to another person using, in our show, one of the distinctions that we have that makes us different to those other shows is that we allowed pantomime, which, you know, really takes you back to that kind of charades idea. I mean, charades with words, which is ultimately, you know, in what we found, it's more freeing, it's more fun, you know, and, you know, like I'm a big proponent of when I work on game shows, it's like I don't want to ever create a rule I don't want to enforce. And so allowing pantomime allows the game to have that flow and energy of communication. You know, so they're communicating with their bodies and with words. Obviously, they can't say parts of the word, you know, being a distinction. I'm kind of rambling here, but the excitement of that kind of transmitting information down the line, I think, is, is just engaging and fun. The challenge being that you don't want to over have too many rules to where it stifles that flow and energy, which is ultimately in a run through, you're doing that. And it's, you're playing by rules, but the rules are a little bit loose. We're not playing for money. So making that into a real game show that's under game show guidelines and fair for everyone to play, it's like that's where, we try to make it as fun and freeing, yet still maintaining rules that, keep it completely fair, if that makes sense.
Get a Clue is GSN's first original game show of 2020 in this decade. It premiered on Monday. You can catch it at 4 p.m. Eastern time on GSN, available on cable and satellite. We've got the executive producer of the program, Greg Brooks, with us. He is live from Los Angeles this half hour. On Tomorrow will be televised. Simon, I'm with you live from New York on the other end of the U.S. of A. Delighted to have you with us on the program All About Television, second Friday of 2020. And if you have a question or comment for Craig, give us a ring, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Coming on Monday on our program, the AMC family of networks is launching next weekend a brand new show. It's called Seven Worlds, One Planet. It's the newest natural history miniseries from the BBC, narrated by the great Sir David Attenborough, and the first episode will deal with Australia. That's a change from the original plan because of, obviously, all the concern about the Australian wildfires that are still going on as we speak on that down-under continent. We will have the executive producer of that series, Johnny Keeling. He'll be in New York on Monday. We'll have him live on Monday, an exclusive interview. That's Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, right here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Craig, explain the rules of Get a Clue and how it leads to people winning big money.
So in our earlier rounds, I mean, basically it's a clue of giving and guessing words or phrases based on the early rounds have categories. So, you know, our teams are two teams of four competing against each other. And these are people who know each other. Relationships are very important in this show because, you know, what we love more than anything is when someone says they get the word. Say, for instance, I'm giving the clue to you, and I say, oh, it's what your brother does for a living, and you say unemployed. And so right away you're getting to something that just because we know each other, we're related or we're a couple or whatever the relationship may be with the players, if I said, it's what we had for dinner last night, there's that great shorthand. So, you know, we cast groups of people who were friends or family or combinations thereof. And so ultimately they're in round one, they're given a category, and the category might be, say it was Prince. And so then every one of the words would be involving something to do with the artist Prince. So ultimately they're going to have a little bit of an idea once the start of the game happens. The category has been revealed. We have our first person to start us off as our team captain. They're given a word and the clock starts. And ultimately their goal is to, to try to get five words in 30 seconds. And if they can get all of them, they'll win the bonus points for that. So it's a timed game. It's fun because everybody's working quickly. And there's that added fun of that, the fact that they know each other. They're, they have that kind of knowledge of the other person so that they can quickly, hopefully, they have knowledge of the other person. They can quickly get to what the word is. You know, it's your favorite song to dance to. Oh, a Purple Rain? Yeah. You know, so right away, you know, it can help them out. So then we basically in round one, each team gets two turns to try to score as many points as possible. Round two is we're just upping the value of the points, but it's still communicating down the line, trying to get to that bonus. They get those bonus points. And then in round three, we shift things to where we take two of the members from each team who are going to represent. So the team that's in the lead would play first. And then ultimately, they're going to look at our main game screen. And on that main game screen, there's a 200-point, 400-point, and 600-point possible words. And then in the last 15 seconds, a 2,000-point word becomes available. So ultimately, they're, one person's in the driver's seat as the clue giver, and one person is the guesser in that round three. And so they're picking off of that giant board. They're picking what they think, you know, a 200-point word will be a very easy word, to deliver, hopefully, where a 600-point word would be a difficult word to relay. But they're in the driver's seat so that they can choose the, you know, the point value, a word will be revealed, and then ultimately they're giving clues to that. If they feel like they're not successful, they can pass and then pick a new point value and a new word will pop up. So some of our teams played it safe and they would pick 200-point and then they would 200-point, they would get it correct, 200-point, where some teams would, you know, start off with a 600-point word. And then, you know, ultimately we have that last 15 seconds of their one-minute round. They have the 2,000-point word becomes available. And those are really extremely difficult words, that they may or may not be able to. It might be a Hail Mary, you know, for them to go for that 2,000-point word. And in our series, we had quite a few people, get that 2,000-point word and have a comeback. So team that's in the lead plays first in that round, and they rack up as many points as they can. And then the team that's trailing, they have a shot. They have 60 seconds to try to overtake the other team. We have our winning team, and that team goes on to our final round for a shot at $10,000. And Yeah, so ultimately they have 60 seconds to, you know, to try to get 8 words in that final round, and if they do, they get $10,000. Now, the difference in that final round is they're light up podiums that basically determine who's the giver and who's the guesser. So the roles aren't down the line anymore. You have to really pay attention to see what your role is. If you're the giver, the first giver, which is the team captain, starts us off, so at least we know that much, they're going to be giving clues to a word on their screen to someone else who's playing on their team. That person is then going to guess. If they guess correctly, they'll receive a new word. They have to give clues to someone else. It might be the same person that they were just getting clues from. So it's kind of a little bit of a ping pong back and forth all over the place in that final round, which is fun because it takes what the skills we've learned and then test them in a new way, which is hopefully exciting and fun for the audience to watch. It was fun for us to produce and watch. And if they're successful, they'll walk away with a nice $10,000 prize.
When you put rounds together, you and your production team, how do you determine what words or phrases you use for a round? For example, in that pre-bonus round, how do you determine which one is the 200-point word, the 600-point word, and the big go-for-the-marbles 2,000-point word?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is on feel, and a lot of it is on testing. And internally, you know, one of the great parts of being a game show producer is playing the games. And, you know, I love to play games, and the producers I work with do as well. So, you know, as we play the game in the office, you know, very quickly you can determine, you know, that if it's a word, especially because we incorporate pantomime and charades style gameplay, that if it's a word that if it's a punch or if it's lips or ear, I mean, it's something that I can just point to on my face. That's a pretty easy word in the sense that it would be a 200-point word. I wouldn't make the word kick a 400-point word. But then you get into words that are more conceptual, you know, that would be examples of something that would take, you know, you know, an envelope might be a 400-point word in that it's like, okay, you know, or it might be a 200-point word, but it's almost 400-point words. It's a little bit more than just a physical gesture or a very simple thing. You know, it's a sound that dogs make. Okay, bark. That would be probably a 200-point word. But so ultimately, it's a matter of trial and error, and then kind of playing through this to kind of get a sense. And after a while, you really do get a feel of like, oh, that's definitely a 600-point word. It's somewhat subjective, of course, but I do have a sense that after, you know, having, you know, and stacking our games and building out lists of 400-point words or 200-point words or 600-point words, you very quickly start to go, oh, that's definitely a 600-point word. And then, you know, how do they get there? How did we get there as we're playing it in the room is always important, because it's like if there's, you know, if there's multiple ways, Simon, to get to a word, then it's like, okay, that feels a little bit easier than, no, if they do this series of clues, it's really probably the most efficient, best way. And if that's time-consuming, well, that could then become a 600-point word or even potentially a 2,000-point word. You know, something like counterintelligence, which is a word you could break down into two different pieces. You know, when I'm at a diner, I sit at the counter. Yeah, counter. And then if I'm really smart, or I take one of these tests to test how smart I am, it's an intelligence test or intelligence quotient, IQ test. Yeah, what does the I stand for? Intelligence. Okay, we'll put them together. You said counter. If you say the word, I can repeat the word back to you. You said counter and say intelligence. Counter, intelligence, ding, we got the correct answer. So there are ways you can, contestants strategy-wise, can, and this is all in the briefing that we give to contestants, off-camera briefings, is that, you know, if a word is said, they can repeat the word back to their partner. But so a word like counterintelligence is probably a 2,000-point word, because ultimately it's a word that it can be done. Can it be done in 15 seconds? Well, if they're very clever, very smart players, then yes, they can do it. It can be done, because we've done it in a run through or in a you know, in the office practicing and playing. Some of the words are very difficult, and you know, and it's purposeful in that 2,000 one, because you want it to be a level of word that if they get it and win the game based on that, that it felt like they earned it, if that makes sense.
Yeah. An early episode I saw, it seemed that Rob came off very, very well, very polished, could really handle the format, could handle the contestants, could handle the clock and so forth. How long did it take for Rob to get adjusted to the pace of doing a game show as a host?
He took to it very well. And in fact, I think, his improv training, his stage presence, and, I've worked with a lot of game show hosts, and everybody, it's a tremendous benefit if they have stage experience, whether it's, Ben Glebe, I worked with him, I was a showrunner on Idiot Test, whether it's him or Cedric the Entertainer, I did a show with Cedric, and, stage experience, whether it's as a stand-up comedian or whether it's as an improvisational actor and part of an improvisational troupe, I think that that's super beneficial, and he had that in spades. And, of course, it's in his blood, I think, to perform. and so he came into it. And also with, if you talk with him, you'll find immediately he's one of the nicest people with a tremendous work ethic. And so we worked and worked and worked because, ultimately with game shows, you want to know the rules and there's a little bit of traffic cop that you have to play as a host, in knowing the rules. But there's also, you have to keep the momentum going and, the exposition of gameplay, we always try to keep that to a minimum, and keep everything simple, for home audience and players. And those are the best games. But he took to it really, really quickly, and he also put in the time and energy and work so that when we got to the place when we were ready to shoot, he was he knew it cold and was able to then build on that. And the best game show hosts are ones who can take a format and elevate it, and I think that's what Rob did. And you always hope for that. You always hope that, surely, at the very minimum, we want our hosts to service the game and in a way that makes it fun and engaging. But more than anything, you hope that they will take what you've created and elevate it by injecting their personality, their flavor, and and their comedy, in this case, into the show. And that's what I think Rob did. And it was a joy to work with him. And it's nice to see. And it's a very quick game too. It's very fast paced, and there's a lot of things to key in on and moments that we want to revisit, when we've seen a round play that were funny or unique he has a good mind for finding those little moments and pointing them out, which was always fun.
Craig, I know you have a meeting to run to. Before I let you go, you mentioned Idiot Test. Would you say that of the previous game shows you worked on, that was your favorite?
I don't know. I mean, it's hard to pick. I have two children. I couldn't pick a favorite. It's hard to pick. They all have a place. I love that show. It was one of those shows that, writing, whether it's writing the tests and Ben Glebe's flavor in comedy and kind of take on game show hosting. There's definitely, we did over 210 episodes of the show. So it definitely has a place in my heart for sure. But it's hard to pick a favorite. I created with Larry Barron, Emo Genius, which was another show that I was for Game Show Network was very fond of. They're all different, and they're all kind of so it's kind of the last one is the one that sticks with you a lot, I think. So I'm excited about Get a Clue and very excited to see how people take it in and respond.
And week two of Get a Clue begins this Monday, 4 p.m. Eastern Time on GSN, Game Show Network. Check your local Webback channels available in the area on cable and satellite. For more details about the film online, here's where you go, www.gsntv.com. That's www.gsntv.com. It's the network's first original game show of this year and this decade. It's Get a Clue, hosted by Rob Belushi, Mondays and Fridays through Fridays, 4 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time on GSN. Craig Brooks, the executive producer, thank you again for joining us. Congratulations on getting this new show off the ground. Hopefully a great long run in store, and we'd love to have you back anytime. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, well, thank you, Simon. It's great to be on the show, and Happy New Year to you and to your listeners. And check out Get a Clue. It's 4 p.m. Eastern time on Game Show Network, as you said. And hope you watch and enjoy.
And I think people are going to have a great time, too. And Rob is destined for great things, I think, as a host and whatever else he wants to do, too. Thanks again, Craig. All the greatest. Have a super weekend.
Hey, thanks, you too. Take care, Simon. Bye.
Craig Brooks, executive producer of Get a Clue from Game Show Network, joining us live from Los Angeles. And now, as promised, let's give you the latest news notes. As CBS meets winter television critics tour attendees in Los Angeles today, Bloomberg Television is a few hours away from relaunching a public television staple of the past. Wall Street Week, created by original host Louis Rukeyser and a Friday night CBS fave for 32 years, ending in 2005, returns tonight at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg. This WSW will be a weekly hour hosted by David Weston with a rotating group of panelists. Each episode will focus on two or three key business developments. Fox Business Network revived WSW in 2016 with Maria Bartiromo anchoring. That series, now known as Maria Bartiromo's Wall Street, continues on Fox Business. Relevant Public Television, the originator of the PBS WSW, will co-produce this version with Bloomberg. Again, it premieres at 6 p.m. Eastern Time tonight. Goodbye Peacock Productions, the NBC News unit producing documentary series and specials for MSNBC, Lifetime, A&E, and other channels, will shut down March 2nd after 13 years of operation. Some quickie before we move on. Ken Jennings needs one more game to win Jeopardy's ABC $1 million tournament after last night's episode. More than 50 million people watched Jennings' second victory last night. Round 4 comes on ABC Tuesday night. And Steve Austin's Straight Up series returns to USA Network this summer. Expect 8 more episodes for Season 2. And that is news notes for today. And before we go any further, let's hear from our wonderful sponsor, the fine folks at Audible.com. If you saw the movie Founder last Saturday night on Turner Classic Movies as part of The Essentials, hosted by Ava DuVernay and Ben Mankiewicz, I think you'll like a very prize-winning book that's a New York Times bestseller. It's called Where the Crawdads Sing by Delia Owens. And you can get that book, with a lot of flavor like Founder, available right now through Audible.com. It's one of three priority books you can get right now under a one-month trial. You know, Audible.com is the leading provider of spoken digital audio entertainment, information, and by far, inspiration. There's over 180,000 titles to choose from. Listen to them on any device, including whatever you're hearing us on right now. That's Lock Talk Radio, Spreaker, and iHeartRadio. Just sign up at audibletrial.com/televised. That's audibletrial.com/televised. One free audio book, two more, along with a great catalog of Audible originals, and 1 month trial, plus great customer service from Audible's parent, Amazon.com. And by those two free audio books, in addition to the one free you normally get in a trial offer, we're talking about the growing catalog of Audible originals. That includes One Woman, One Man shows, the best of Broadway, off-Broadway, and regional theaters around the country, and original audio productions made especially for Audible. And it's all available to you under a one-month trial. Three audio books, absolutely free, and great customer service from Audible.com's parent, Amazon.com. If you're still looking for a great gift to kick the year off or decade on, well, this is the one for you or someone you love. Nothing like hearing for yourself how the way can work the world for you, or how the way you hear the world, I should say. So give it a try at audibletrial.com/televised. That's audibletrial.com/televised. You will be so happy you or someone you know did. This is Tomorrow's Televised. We have the program all about the 2 in our 13th year on the air. We're coming your way live Mondays and Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern New Pacific, other days too sometimes, on blogtalkradioandspreaker.com. And it was a week ago that we had a fantastic show with Lawrence Schmidt-Hisrick, the creator, executive producer of the new Netflix phenomenon, The Witcher. We had over 100 people listening live on the program and nearly 400 replays since. If you missed that episode, you can go, after we do our show today, to blogtalkradio.com/televised. That's blogtalkradio.com/televised. You can also go to our podcast label, which is iTunes, Apple TV, the Spreaker podcast app, and, of course, iHeartRadio.com. That's iHeartRadio.com. If you go to the latter site, make sure you put Tomorrow Be Televised in the search bar, click, and you get our episode. And thank you to everybody who tuned in live last Friday, as well as everybody who's listened to us on replay ever since. And incidentally, all those podcast sites and our homepage is where you get all of our recent episodes and all our episodes of 2019 and earlier. So while you have a chance this weekend or later tonight, binge a little bit. Binge listen, if you will, to the program All About Television. Once again, you can catch it at blogtalkradio.com/televised, on iTunes, Apple TV, the Spreaker podcast app, and www.iHeartRadio.com. When we come back, before our classic trivia question of the week, we're having Elvis in the place. Elvis' 85th birthday was this week. How did TV play a role in Elvis' rise to top and staying on top in the 60s. We'll have historian, author, and expert about Elvis P. Frank D'Onofrio will join us live, and he'll be with us live from Maryland after we pause at the bottom of the hour for web identification. This is Best Internet Radio in the Galaxy, www.blogtalkradioandspreaker.com. Together reaching more than 35 million listeners around the world every month and growing. Check out Sports Time Radio. We'll bring you up to date on the NFL's divisional playoff action this weekend. Also, the college football playoff coming Monday night. And, of course, all the great college and pro basketball and hockey action throughout the weekend. Sports Time Radio today, 6 p.m. Eastern, VW City, only on Blog Talk Radio and Speaker. And don't forget Best Beat Time Speaker 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to half hour number two of this 90-minute edition of Tomorrow Be Televised, the program all about TV. Simon Avon with you live from New Web, New York. Great to have you with us. More great guests coming your way in the hour ahead. And we invite you as always to be interactive with us. What you got to do, make a call and raise that voice, 646-652-2906. Or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Put your thoughts in the room. That's SimonApple04 by name. Or make the call. Either way, we will reach you. This would have been, this week, Elvis Presley's 85th birthday, had he lived past when he died some decades ago. And believe it or not, it was television that really helped get Elvis on top as one of the all-time great musical and entertainment superstars. And that was in the 50s, and in the 60s, late 60s to be more specific, it was television that got him back on top at a very interesting time, a turning point in his career. Last February, we had an expert about Elvis Presley be on the program talk about one of the unknown forces in his life that made Elvis the superstar that he was. We enjoyed that interview last February, and we're delighted today to have him back. Joining us live from Conowingo, Maryland, that's between Philadelphia and Baltimore, a very good friend of mine from my dealings with Landmark Worldwide, the Personal Development and Training Association associated with the Landmark Forum. It's great to have back on the program, Presley author, historian, and expert, Frank D'Onofrio. Happy to have you back again, Frank.
Yeah, thank you, Simon. Great to be here.
What do you think about the most in terms of Elvis on his 85th birthday this week, especially when it comes to the role television played in getting his career way off the ground?
Well, first thing that people need to understand about Elvis Presley was that he did not do a lot of television. It was the medium that took him to the greatest heights that he's ever experienced. But unfortunately, his manager felt that he was exploited by television and that he couldn't make the kind of money that he felt that his client deserved. So Elvis had a very limited amount of television after he hit the top. That's pretty much how it worked. Now, prior to becoming the quote-unquote king of rock and roll, Elvis begged to be on television. It was the way to get him to the masses. But once that occurred, the colonel took a back. The colonel took that back, and basically Elvis went into the army, and it was used in a number of times to put Elvis in front of the audiences that he needed to get to. And I wouldn't say he was hamstrung by his manager, but I will say that his manager limited the amount of time that he spent on television.
Frank, one thing we didn't get to last February, I want to get to today, especially in light of his birthday this week. Did Elvis in the 50s get a lot of offers to do his own variety show on television, as many singers did, like Perry Como or Andy Williams, or, for example, to do a dramatic series or a comedy?
No. Well, first of all, in terms of the dramatic series, let's talk about that for a second. Elvis was a very good actor. The problem was that the formula that his management used in order to make him into a superstar did not translate into dramatic roles. So Elvis had gone into – before Elvis went into the Army, he did a couple of very, very good dramatic roles. He did Jailhouse Rock and he did King Creole. Both of them were dramatically great films. And they were the type of films that were James Dean-esque, the rebel, and the rebel without a cause kind of individual. And Elvis fit right into that mold. He was a young man in his early 20s, and that was perfect. However, after he went into the Army, the colonel kind of shied away from those roles because he wanted his protege, he wanted his client, to be seen as the all-American boy. However, prior to Elvis's rise, the idea was to get him as much publicity as possible, and television was the way to do that.
Yeah. By the way, we're talking about Tom Parker being the colonel.
Yes.
If the colonel objected to him doing a regular series, would he, if let's say the producers of a Rawhide or Wagon Train or a anthology show like Playhouse 90 in the 50s, early 60s, had come to Parker and Presley and said, okay, we get you don't want to do a weekly series, but do a special, do a Dick Powell Theater, do a Bob Hope Presents the Chrysler Theater, do a Virginian, as I said, a Rawhide, something that would give you an opportunity to flourish in an episode. Was any of that ever considered?
No, that wasn't considered. And the reason it wasn't considered was he was already doing that in the movies. So Colonel Tom Parker was very, very strong about not saturating his client. He didn't oversaturate with sending out records and albums at the same time. For example, when Elvis went into the Army, there was a discussion about how much music would Elvis record before going into the Army and how that would be released. Well, basically, what the colonel did was he recorded, to say, about two or three albums worth of songs, all right, and then stopped recording. Why did he do that? Because he wanted Elvis's hits to come out at certain periods of time. Do you always remember, Elvis never did an encore, ever. Elvis finished his show, and you would hear, Elvis has left the building, thank you, good night. That's it. Elvis never came back and did an encore. He would always leave the crowd wanting more. And that was the influence of Colonel Parker. However, let's go back to the what you talked about, which was the kind of variety shows. The Elvis special in 1968, which is termed, quote unquote, the comeback special. Elvis said, "I didn't come back from nowhere." That's his exact words. Was supposed to be an Andy Williams type Christmas show. However, the producer who came in from NBC had sat down with Elvis and said, "Elvis, you do not want to do this." And Elvis agreed. It is not something he didn't want to sit by a Christmas tree and sit around a Christmas tree and sing songs. That was just not Elvis's persona. It wasn't his personality. And as a result, what had transpired was the 68 special, which became, quote unquote, the comeback special. The promise that was made to Elvis was, I will make you relevant again. And it did, because it showed Elvis in his element. This was now a polished, very smooth performer who understood his market and understood his fan base. However, Elvis was also frightened. And you would say, how could Elvis be frightened? Prior to that show, he sat down he was about to go out the show and told him he didn't want to go out there. Now, Elvis did that three times in his career. He did that the first time he sang in front of a group of people in the Bel Air Club in Memphis, Tennessee. And he did it at right before he went on to the Ed Sullivan show. And then lastly, he did it right before this, before the 68 special. And he was, if for lack of a word, he felt that he was, he had the confidence, but basically he had to get pushed out there. Once he went out there, all hell broke loose and the audience loved him. And it's amazing. some of the things that had occurred and how he became Elvis Presley. Well, Elvis was a consummate artist, and he always went out there and tried to make his fans appreciate who he was and what he stood for and the music that he portrayed. A couple of great things that had occurred during the 68 special was, now if anybody understands, if anyone recalls, 68 was when Martin Luther King was assassinated, and also when Robert Kennedy was assassinated. Elvis wanted to make a statement, and he contracted a writer to write a song based on Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, which Elvis had a habit of performing to his friends and family verbatim. He studied it. He loved the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. He was appalled at the murder, and he wanted to make a statement. And the song in the 68 special was If I Can Dream. And the legend is, and this is, and I confirmed it with a few people. The legend is that Elvis sang that song so powerfully that at the end he fell to his knees on a concrete floor and was exhausted. And if you take a look at the presentation in the 68 special, you can see that he wanted to make a statement. Colonel Parker, however, had different ideas and was very appalled at doing a song, a civil rights song. He felt that Elvis was stepping over his boundaries, but Elvis would hear nothing of that. He wanted that song. And throughout the filming of the 68 special, Colonel kept saying, "Where's my Christmas song? Where's my Christmas? I want a Christmas song." So Elvis did Blue Christmas.
By the way, that special was for NBC, and we should also point out that it came at a time when Elvis had one of his most unique hit songs, In the Ghetto, which was also a civil rights song. And later on, one of Elvis's major post-special hits, one of the final hits of his career, was his American Trilogy, which was a sort of salute to America, which was also very stirring.
Elvis felt very strongly about the civil rights movement. People will need to understand that Elvis's affinity for the black culture and the black movement was very strong. It is what defined him as an artist. He grew up in Memphis. He grew up in the shadow of Beale Street. He had a friend of his, the person that introduced him to the world, Dewey Phillips, who was the Memphis DJ, who actually introduced the world to Elvis Presley, who unfortunately, and Simon, we need to do a show on Dewey Phillips and why he's not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. That's a travesty for the world, that the man who introduced Elvis to the world is not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I mean, it's a travesty. But that being said, Dewey took him to Beale Street. Dewey was a Memphis disc jockey who played black rhythm and blues artist for a predominantly white audience. His reach was over a million people a night, all the way, and this is the true story, all the way to Lubbock, Texas, where a young man named Buddy Holly heard him. And he would take him all around, and he would introduce him to some of the greatest artists of the day, Rufus Thomas, B.B. King. And all of those men taught Elvis many of the styles that he had encompassed in his own act. And one of the things Elvis was known for, and many people don't know this, is that Elvis was had a photographic memory. And he knew the effect of a move in a song, and he would put that in his memory, and he would do it again and again. And if he got the same response, that is where it would go in the act. And Elvis was very, very good at appeasing, and not appeasing, but giving the basic what his audience wanted, that's what he delivered. And he was very strong about that. And Elvis did not, at any point in time, Elvis did not ever disrespect his fan base. It was something that he had to do, that he would never do, was disrespect. He knew who got him there. And understand that Elvis came from nothing. The term dirt poor, for those of you who may not know it, means that you came from a home with a dirt floor. That's what dirt poor mean. And Elvis grew up in a single room house, okay? They call it a shotgun house, in Tupelo, Mississippi, with a dirt floor.
We're speaking with Frank DiNapolo. He is the Elvis Presley historian, expert. He's author of a forthcoming book called Elvis the King, about that master of rock and roll. He's with us live between Philadelphia and Baltimore this half hour on Smart Retail Life on the East Coast. Tom Apple with you live also up the coast in New York. We're at 48 degrees at the top of the hour. Happy you're with us for this edition of the program All About Television. If you have a question or comment for Frank, make the call 646-652-2906 or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Next weekend, the AMC family of networks is launching a simulcast of a very unique special from, it's a series actually, from the folks at BBC. It's called Seven Worlds, One Planet. And the first episode will deal with Australia. That has a change from the original schedule because of, obviously, the wildfire situation down under. Johnny Keeling, who is the executive producer of the program, will be in New York on Monday, and we will have him live as our lead guest. Johnny Keeling from Seven Worlds, One Planet, premiering next weekend on AMC, IFC, Sundance Now, and BBC America, live with us Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern Pacific, right here on Suave Televised. Frank, going back to the 50s, a lot of people still remember Elvis Presley's appearances on the Ed Sullivan Show because there was supposed to be this idea that you cannot shoot Elvis from the waist down because of the gyrations. But that was not the only major television series that featured Elvis in the mid-50s. When Jackie Gleason did The Honeymooners back in 1955-56, the so-called 39 half-hour episodes, they also had a companion show called Stage Show, and Presley was on that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that was the Dorsey Brothers show, and it was a lead-in to the Jackie Gleason Honeymooners show. It didn't have the draw that the Ed Sullivan show had, but it was a phenomenal show. It was basically a warm-up act for Jackie Gleason, who also was a band leader, by the way. And Elvis did two songs, Shake, Rattle, Roll, and Flip, Flop, and Fly medley, as well as I Got a Woman, which is a Ray Charles song. And Elvis was unknown when he did the Dorsey Brothers stage show. But some little known information, the prior manager to Elvis Presley tried to get him on the Arthur Godfrey show, okay, which was kind of like the American Idol of the time. And Elvis did not pass that that show. He went down to audition and he didn't make it. Elvis is known to never make the same mistake twice. When he failed at the Grand Ole Opry, 2 weeks later he appeared on the Louisiana Hayride, and Elvis is history after that point, because Elvis knocked out the Louisiana Hayride and was and basically sent the girls home screaming. After the Dorsey Brothers show and the sessions on the Dorsey Brothers show, he then went on the Milton Berle show. And Milton Berle was a very effective show for him. It was out there in California. And Elvis did Hound Dog. And Simon, this is where the filming from the waist up came from. Elvis did a very provocative version of Hound Dog. It was a very provocative version. And the criticism, now put yourself back in the 1950s. I think today we wouldn't find it provocative, but back then they did. It was so provocative that 10 days later, okay, that he was told he got thousands of pan letters, okay, received that he shouldn't have done that. Now, after that show, Elvis now became the new hot commodity. And so the next show that he needed to go on which was the moving up in the ranks, was the Steve Allen Show. So the Steve Allen Show was at the was broadcast at exactly the same time as the Ed Sullivan Show. So on July 1st, 1956, Elvis sang Hound Dog, and then later that night, again, did when he sang Hound Dog, he did the song because Steve Allen refused to Steve Allen kind of mocked him. Okay, he mocked his southernness. He mocked his and kind of ridiculed him. He put him in a tuxedo to sing to a dog live, and that's where he sang Hound Dog live. A lot of people thought it was Elvis didn't care. He knew it was a gag. He understood that situation. He understood what was going on, and he went with it. And he gave his fans what they wanted. But when he came back to Memphis, and once again, when he came back to Memphis that weekend, he had a performance that weekend. And Dewey Phillips introduced Elvis. And Elvis got up on stage and said, "Those people in New York ain't going to change me none." Those were his exact words. And he went out and killed it. At that point, the Ed Sullivan Show called.
Yeah. So is there anything that you see? So instead of breaks a little bit of a stereotype, it was Ed Sullivan that ordered the camera shot from the waist up. It actually was earlier before that. But I wanted to ask, were there any shows that Elvis wanted to be on, like American Bandstand, like other variety, like the Gary Moore Show, like other variety shows of that time, mid-50s, late-50s, early-60s, that Presley wanted to be on and could not get on because either his manager intervened or because he didn't like the format of the show?
Well, okay, now understand something. After the Ed Sullivan shows, okay, and I make this point in my book, Elvis the King, is that the Ed Sullivan Show on the first Ed Sullivan Show on September 26th, 1956, was the day that Elvis was officially crowned the King of Rock and Roll. That performance on that show changed his career for his entire life. Elvis did two other Ed Sullivan shows after that. And after the third Ed Sullivan Show, Elvis went into the Army, so he was prohibited from performing after he went into the Army. And that was the time that the Dick Clark Show came up. And in addition to that, Elvis, when he came back from the Army, went directly into movies. And there was a couple of reasons why Elvis went into movies. The first reason was that his manager, Colonel Parker, felt that Elvis could be seen by more people in a movie than he could in any other place. Now understand, Elvis made millions of dollars, and the story goes that the most bankable project during the 60s was an Elvis movie. It was guaranteed to make at least $1 million. He did three movies a year. He would make $1 to $1.5 million on every movie, plus $1 million for every one of the soundtracks that were issued. When Elvis did a dramatic role, the take wasn't that big, the formula wasn't that big, and Colonel had a habit, and this was one of the other habits that the Colonel had, was that he felt Elvis could sing the phone book and have a number one hit. And so after Lieber and Stoller, who wrote Jailhouse Rock and all the wonderful artists, Elvis started to do formula music that he was given by his handlers, Colonel Parker and such, and the quality wasn't that great. And it wasn't until Steve Binder and the 1968 special that Steve Binder said, "I'm going to make you relevant again, because the music you're doing isn't good, and we're also going to show people in the 68 special why you are the King of Rock and Roll." And please take a look at that 68 special. There was more energy for the hour and a half that Elvis, and it was aired as an hour, then after he passed, they showed the whole hour and a half. There was more energy in that 1 hour of music that Elvis did in the 68 special than could be mustered for the entire tribute that they did last year for that 68 special. It was amazing at the amount of energy that Elvis put out on the stage. It was amazing. And it showed why he was the king of rock and roll.
Yeah, I agree. That Elvis comeback special, the Elvis special on NBC, was one of his great highlights of anything he did. And Steve Binder, the producer director, was very much responsible for that. He went on to do a lot more great musical specials, including my all-time favorite, the Diana Ross and Central Park concert, which was live on Showtime. And it was one of the most extraordinary events you ever will see, because that was the night of the thunderstorm, and Ross stayed on that stage, and anyone who saw that special live will never, ever forget that special. It was...
Absolutely.
And then she
then
went
you
ahead
have,
and
you
did
can't.
The same thing again the following night, and it was the same thing start to finish. And it was a love-in, an absolute love-in.
You can't forget the Aloha from Hawaii concert, okay?
Yeah.
Which was broadcast. That was a phenomenal show, Simon. Okay, it was broadcast live throughout the world except in New York, where it wasn't broadcast live. It was broadcast on tape. But that was a brilliant performance of Elvis in his prime. It was. After that, he unfortunately went downhill. And then lastly, one of the things that you may not know is Elvis also appeared after he came back from the Army. He appeared on the Frank Sinatra Show. And sang with Frank Sinatra.
Which was a one-shot special, I believe. Or a
yeah, it was
a
one-shot special. He came and sang. Yeah, that's correct.
And you can see it on YouTube. I've seen that special on YouTube. It's quite interesting. Unfortunately, Frank, we have to run. I wish we could go longer and longer and longer. Because we'd like to have covered some of the things he did in television afterwards. You mentioned the Hawaii special, which was a very unique special in the way it was put together unto itself. And he did another special that was also syndicated in some fashion. But sort of to wrap it up, when are you going to be coming out with your book, Elvis the King? And any other thoughts about whether, had Elvis lived past when he died, would he have done television? Would he have done more television? Would he have done different kinds of things? What would have been his TV role, if anything? And I know it's all speculation, but I'm just curious.
From a speculative standpoint, I think Elvis, would have dropped the colonel. I think there were competing people out there, Dick Clark and so on and so forth, who were probably going to get to him at some point and break him down and say, Elvis, you know, you're not being handled properly, because he really wasn't. The problem with Elvis Presley was that he had accomplished everything. He had become the leader in almost every medium. And unfortunately, he got bored. And, you know, people do crazy things when they're bored with their lives. And then secondly, it was an unfortunate part, because I really think that if he had a manager at the latter part of his career, like a Dick Clark, Elvis could have gone to super heights. And lastly, the Colonel didn't want Elvis to be upstaged by anybody. And some of the poor moves that he made was not having a sequel to any movie with Ann Margaret, which is the first thing. Elvis and Ann Margaret were magic together. It was amazing how those two together could change a room and the color of a room just by showing up together. And secondly, he turned down a project with Barbara Streisand to do A Star Is Born, which would have transformed his career and possibly won him an Academy Award. I really feel that. Now, in terms of other books, I'm trying to get this book published, Simon. The publishing world is about as crazy as politics, unfortunately. The publishing world seems to think that Elvis isn't hot anymore, and do not feel that my book will sell the number of copies that they need to make. I disagree with them. My agent disagrees with them. The book is well written. It is written not as a salacious tome. It's written as a historical analysis of why specifically he is the king of rock and roll. And they take you into the studio in 1956 in the head of the young Elvis Presley, and how he paced the room and was created That's All Right, Mama, out of nothing. And I take you to that point. The next book I'm working on is a book called The Day After, which chronicles the day after the music died. It chronicles the what rock and roll became after Elvis went into the army, after Buddy Holly's death, and the Brill Building kind of music that's going on now. I'm working on that book right now.
Two more TV-related Elvis factoids before we let you go. If you've ever seen Jailhouse Rock, you can find it regularly on Turner Classic Movies. Check out the supporting performance by one Judy Tyler. She used to be one of the stars of the Howdy Doody show. It was one of her few movies, and sad to say she died shortly after the film was
yes.
made and not yet released.
Elvis was heartbroken.
And she would have had a fantastic career. I'm sorry, go ahead. Frank.
Elvis was heartbroken. That was something that really hit him hard. Yeah, he was heartbroken that she passed away. It was a great performance. It was one of his best performances. That and King Creole were two of his best performances. And it's unfortunate the world never got to see Elvis Presley in a very good dramatic piece, because he would have knocked the house down. He would have won an Academy Award, really.
And the second factoid along with that, with a TV event, is that in the late 1960s, Elvis did do at least one more dramatic role. It was a film called Change of Habit. And it was a film where he played a priestly type of character. It was directed by William Graham, a wonderful TV episodic and later made-for-TV movie director. And the co-star was Mary Tyler Moore. If you have never seen that film, check it out. It's a very underrated movie.
It is. It was. And it's a very fun movie. And it really was... it was the transition, because Elvis had now transitioned more towards the live performances after the 68 special. One other thing, after the 68 special was completed and it came out, the Colonel got into the limousine as they're leaving the studios in Burbank, and he turns to Elvis and says, "You know what? We got to take this on the road. We got to do this on the road." And the next day he signed a contract with the Las Vegas Hilton, okay, to open the International Hotel in Las Vegas, and the 68 special was the turning point in Elvis's career. Again, it brought him back to prominence in the music industry.
Frank D'Onofrio, Elvis Presley historian, expert, author. Great to have you with us on this week. We'll remember Elvis on his 85th birthday. It's been a delightful pleasure this last half hour. Let's have you back on soon. And all the very best to you for a wonderful 2020 and decade ahead.
Thanks, Simon. Good to talk to you.
You got it, Frank. Take care. Enjoy. Frank D'Onofrio joining us live from somewhere between Philadelphia and Baltimore in Conowingo, Maryland. When we come back, we'll go live to Valencia, California, and we'll speak with the head of media entertainment for an interesting company called Reach3 Insights. Her name is Velma Benoit. We'll get her thoughts about binge or no binge viewing. What's happening with that in this era of smart TV tech, smart TV devices, and plentiful television? She'll join us live, plus one of our class trivia questions, after we call us after the top of the hour for web identification. www.blogtalkradioandspeaker.com. 135 minutes around the world every month and growing. Catch the January Jones Show, Monday, 10 a.m. Eastern, 7 a.m. Pacific. It's January Jones. It's all about success stories and women making them happen. January Jones, Monday, 10 a.m. Eastern, 7 a.m. Pacific, right here on Blog Talk Radio and Speaker. Remember, best to be charged 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to the final half hour of Tomorrow Be Televised. One of those just joining us at the top of the hour, signing out with you live from New Weber, York. Request your comment for our next guest. Ring it in, 646-652-2906. The numbers get anywhere you're capturing across the country, around the globe, here on BTR and Speaker. And we got our chat room open. Coming up, we'll do it for me. We've got some people in the room, so stay in the room. If you like, put your comment in there or make the call. Either way, we will get to you. Earlier this week at the start of the TV Critics Tour in Los Angeles, John Landgraf, the chief executive of FX, said that for all of 2019, there were 538 original scripted series shown on U.S. television. Think about that, 538. And many of them, people watched by binging them, episode after episode at a time, 8, 10, 12, 13 episodes, a full season's worth. Well, as we start 2020, and this new decade of this era of smart TV sets and devices, this era of plentiful television, diversity, and so forth, is binge TV still the case? Or is a new form of television watching about to happen? Well, an interesting company called Reach3 Insights has been doing some insightful work on that. And joining us right now to talk about it live from Valencia, California, in the area of Los Angeles, is its head of media entertainment, Melva Benoit. Melva, welcome.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure, Melva. So what does your new study say about binge watching? Is it going into this year and decade ahead as big as ever, or are we starting to see a bubble burst?
It's interesting. I don't know that I would say necessarily that a bubble burst. And without making this answer too long, binge watching has always been. It's just now when we binge watch, we watch one show versus when you would sit in front of television and just veg out if you had the time. And young people have always done this. They've turned the TV on and just let it play out. Now what streaming has allowed for you to do is to have a little bit of choice of what you're watching. But also, if you remember, cable in its early days used to marathon quite a bit, which is also binge watching. So you would get 12 hours of Law and Order if you really wanted to watch it. So binge watching is not bursting a bubble. If you have the time to watch television in that moment, you do. But what we see is that on average, most people can sit before their butt falls asleep for about 4 hours. And that's always been, if you think about the way prime time is constructed on broadcast television historically. So you watch about 4 episodes. So that's really about as much time as you can give in one sitting. You may try to cram through for social reasons to get through the entire series in the shortest period of time so you can talk to people about it, because television still is social, even though binge watching, according to our research, is really a solo activity. So that's sort of the way I would answer that question.
And now, Marva, we're in this era of mega programming services. We had BET Plus, Disney Plus, Apple TV Plus launch last fall. We've got Peacock coming up in April, HBO Max in May. Who knows who else coming before the end of this year. And it seems that for most of these mega programming services, they are not releasing all the episodes of the season off the bat. They're releasing 1 to 3 1 week and then going a new episode the following week, the following week, the following week. Any thoughts about how that is playing so far with viewers?
It's playing fine with viewers. I mean, look, SVOD means subscription, right? Subscription video on demand. And so the first SVOD or subscription service was HBO. HBO basically would give you the ability to binge, if you will, before the new season, because they would play marathons of episodes back to back. But HBO cares that you pay to watch. They don't care that you watch. So they want you to pay for 3 months. So let's do the math on that. Roughly, they're getting $18 per subscriber. They've got 30 million subscribers. That's a lot of dough, right? Where Netflix's mistake, and it was always sort of interesting to me that they thought that, well, no, people want it all at once. You're a subscription business. Your biggest challenge is churn. You need people to subscribe over long periods of time so you can monetize them, correct? So if I give you everything all at once, what's your incentive to subscribe for more than 2 months? Because now you have the ability to binge watch, which is where this all came about, more of a business term than actual behavior. But it was driven by, wait, you're going to release all the episodes. I can watch this in the least amount of time, and I can cancel the subscription, right? So where the big services, which are coming from traditional TV backgrounds, they're thinking about, look, we're a subscription service. We care that people pay for months at a time. We want to extend their relationship with us. And we know that people, you know, there's still only 24 hours in a day. So a person only has so much time to watch as many episodes as we make available, and they're not going to complain about it as long as there's variety and we've solved some of the challenges around finding the content that they want.
How do you see 2020 playing out, especially as we're going to see Netflix step it up and do more original shows, which they already have started to do? Already we're 10 days into 2020, and Netflix has already premiered 3 or 4 original scripted series, 2 of them today, The RuPaul Show, AJ and the Queen, and Medical Police, both of which have gotten off to some good reviews, good to mixed reviews. And Hulu, Amazon, and so forth, stepping it up. And then, of course, you know, more from Apple TV, more from BET Plus, mm-hmm. more from HBO, and then HBO Max, Peacock, and so forth coming on the scene.
Right. So the biggest challenge comes when you delinearize television is promotion. So we have to go back to what television is, what media is. Media is an advertising platform. Media or television, it's the only industry that takes as much money from itself as it does from others, right? So television shows, television networks spend as much time, streaming services spend as much time spending money on advertising on traditional television to get people to watch as car companies do to get people to buy cars. So the biggest challenge when you're creating more and more content is basically finding audience to get to that content. Do you have enough platforms and methods to basically get people to the content? I, as a consumer, subscribe to everything, but I can't watch what I don't know about, right? And so how do you find me to tell me about that show? And, you know, I can tell when my kid has been in my Netflix because the AI suddenly serves up shows that I would never watch, but my kid was watching under my user. So the biggest challenge I think that's going to come and what the traditional guys are going to do in the streaming wars is they're going to leverage their own platforms and they're going to block the guys that don't have traditional platforms to basically reach people. Because you've got to get people to a show, right? And still, the best way to advertise is TV. If we've blown up all the other mediums, we've blown up print, and what is the actual homepage on Google, right? There is no homepage on Google. There is no homepage for advertising. So how do you find these people? How do you find them and reach them in a way that if they have any interest, you can tell them about your show?
We are speaking with Meadow Van Wash, who's the head of media entertainment for Reach 3 Insights, very interesting company, and we find her today in Valencia, California, this half hour. On Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Simon, I'm done with you live from the other side of the U.S. of A., New York, 48 degrees at the top of the hour. We're expecting 60 degrees tomorrow, and maybe near 70 or more by Sunday. If you have a question or comment for Melba, make the phone ring, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, Simon Apple 04. My name is, stay tuned. We will have our classic trivia question of the week. Stand by. You may win a prize, and you may become our first trivia winner of this new year and decade. Melba, what's your thoughts about the whole smart TV, smart device phenomenon? We're now at a point where the majority of people have these products. They're watching upwards of 10 billion hours of content and apps a month. It's very clear this is how they're watching Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, et cetera. They're not watching on the smartphone or the tablet or the TV or the PC or the laptop. It's on the television set. And we're also seeing this whole new group, a universe, of programming services that are using smart TV sets and smart devices as their way to get to viewers. Services like PassionFlix, Reverie, New Sky Kids, Topic, et cetera, et cetera. Does the research you have show if any of these services are breaking out, or people are actually watching them?
Well, we don't have measurement. What we have is from self-reported viewing, people saying that they're watching and they're watching on more devices. But it's a double-edged sword. If you have enough of a fat pipe coming to your house, then you have a great viewing experience on your smart TV, right? I live in a house where there are five Samsung televisions. The biggest one is 65 inches, and the smallest one is 42 inches. But the internet is uneven with regard to how the pipe comes in, how new the television is, how much the apps show up, and how great the viewing experience is. So what we see and what we've seen is if everything works, meaning they've got a great set, they've got no problems coming in on their Samsung or their LG, and they're able to sort of make their apps work and they have a fat pipe, they're talking about a great experience, right? If not, they're still going back to the traditional players. They're still going back to the things that they know, because it comes back to, I can't find something if I don't have the ability to search. And so UI and all of those other things really matter. I was just looking, CES is producing an 8K television, but there's no 8K content. So you've got to get the right set with the right AI to basically make your 4K content work on your 8K television. And if you don't have a fat enough pipe connected to that television, you're not going to have a great experience because you can't get all the data through. So,
you know,
it's still early.
We just had. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say it's still early, but what's happening is more fragmentation, and with more fragmentation, and until you actually have 5K everywhere, right? 5G. I'm sorry, not 5K. Until you actually have 5G, you're in this little bit of place of 5G changes everything. Everything changes under 5G, but we're not there yet.
We already have now in many smart TV sets and devices artificial intelligence-powered voice features like Siri and Alexa, Google Assistant, et cetera,
right,
allowing people to control the set with their voice. And we know it's already
yes.
making a difference because we're seeing people order products and services through sets and devices and so on. We have Portal TV
yes.
from Facebook that allows you to do video chat and even do augmented reality, which nobody thought would be on the television set. And we're
yes.
supposed to hear that 5G is supposed to become a television feature as much as a smartphone feature.
Right.
First of all, two questions. First of all, what kind of a difference is artificial intelligence voice making with the viewers? And secondly, are you surprised that at the CES, which is about to wrap up in the next few hours, that there was no announcements from no TV set maker, from none of the smart TV device players about new features, new smart apps, AI, 5G, anything like it? It seemed it was more at CES about plant-based foods, which are really quite wonderful, like Impossible Foods and so forth, than it was about here's what Samsung is doing in interactive television. Here's Samsung or here's LG with a new smart TV app that might allow you to control your room temperature.
Right. I was not surprised because I think we've hit an inflection point with regard to what we thought the connected house would be, right? What we thought the connected house would be, how quickly we thought everyone would sort of – everyone's going to want an Alexa or a device in their house so they can start talking to it, because once they start talking to it, it will make their lives better. Everybody's going to want all of their stuff connected. But what's happened now is privacy has come up into play and the realization that, wait a minute, once I bring that device into my house, you're listening to everything that I say. So while it does make it easier – for me to move around and not have to pick up the remote to change the channel on my television, it's like it suddenly occurred to people, it's like, wait a minute, once I open the door to AI, you can now listen to me. You listen to everything. And so I think there's an interesting moment with consumers in this inflection point where for some people it's like, well, yeah, it makes things easier. But then, you know, as my husband found out, which he was pushing me really hard, and I'm married to an over-adopter, about getting Alexa until Alexa started ordering things for him that he didn't ask for because Alexa could hear the television talking, right? It happened. So that's my real life example. So what I think we're having a little bit is there's this idea of moving forward and yes, everything can be connected and it's going to be so great, but then every time something's hacked, every time there's an issue with privacy, every time we find out, wait a minute, as much as this is convenient and made my life better, there's the unintended consequence. And what I think we're seeing now is while televisions, you know, there's still excitement about getting a new TV, they're not moving in the same way. And all the other stuff that has to come around with this connected TV, because if you go back 30 years, 20 years, when you bought a television, that's all you needed and you could have entertainment. Now this is not a television, it's just a screen. So I got to get a screen. I got to get something on that screen. I got to buy a service. Like, it's nothing if I don't actually buy an entire ecosystem, right? And as people are starting to begin to realize, it's like, wait a minute. You know, some TVs actually have a camera so the TV can watch me. Do I want that? So I think we're what the manufacturers are seeing is just a little bit of it, and we've done a little bit of research in and around this. It's just a little bit of, wait a minute, we have to make sure there's enough stuff so that the consumer experience is as good as it can be, because sometimes, particularly when you're in entertainment and you're in these places, you're so far ahead the curve than the average consumer.
So what needs to be done for the smart sets and smart makers to get off this and showcase these new apps and services that can make in the right proper way make a difference with the viewer's experience, whether it's an interactive service that allows you to order products and services, or whether it is the ability to book your travel reservations, or to have somebody read, as in the case of Portal TV, have somebody read to your kids on the other end of the screen using augmented reality to sort of make the story more imaginative. How do we get over that so that people really see what you can do with these television sets and these TV devices?
Part of that is deciding to be more transparent, and I don't know if they'll do that. You know, you have two kinds of operating systems, if you will. You have closed or open. And in a transparent world, that means we're all working on the same protocols, right, so that we can share content across. Right now, technology has moved in such a way that it's much more about isolation. I want to get you into my system because I have the best content. But consumers don't move in that way, and they actually, quite frankly, don't care, right? They're going to pick one or the other, right? And that's the content they'll be exposed to. And if we want to move the majority of people along, then there has to be some collaboration. It happened in the beginning with streaming and movies, where the various movie companies realized we have to actually combine efforts on the tech side so that we have standards on the quality of pictures that we make, right? So they defined HD and SD and Technicolor. They defined protocols for streaming, right? With these guys, the Sony's and LG's, they'd have to decide that, you know what, let's combine forces and set protocol, right? It's not been done in telecommunications in a very long time, because once the cell phones, you know, once the companies sort of spread apart, it's like AT&T is building 5G one way, and you know, these other guys, they're going to build another way, because free enterprise, we'll see who wins. Whereas there, you go into another country, it's like there's one protocol and we're all working towards that, which actually gives the consumer the ability to adapt at greater numbers. When there's tons of choices, it takes a while, because you don't know as a consumer if you should place that bet, right? Because, and so you're waiting for the early guys to place the bet and for it to get better and for it to get to the second and third version. So if there's going to be some sort of collaboration in the way to think, let's put the consumer at the front of this, because we've got to get the consumer to move. And because, you know, economy and how we work, we haven't been able to do that. But that's what's going to get the consumer to move to the next place.
Now, before we let you go, two things. First of all, your thoughts about interactive television. How far is it going to advance this year now that we have things like Food Network Kitchen? We have Netflix doing interactive series as well as specials. We have Portal TV. And secondly, you mentioned 5G earlier. How fast do you see 5G being adopted for television, and what will it provide?
Well, I'll start with the latter first. 5G, the promise of 5G is to make all of those interactive, all of those experiences much better, because we no longer have the issues of data constraint. So right now, and I used to say this jokingly, if everybody streams on Netflix at the same time, then it doesn't work, right? Because there's capacity issues. 5G takes that away, right? Because of the construct of what 5G is, you have unlimited bandwidth, if I remember my technical lessons. And so in a world where there's unlimited bandwidth, it's much easier to have a better user experience for inexperiences that require so much bandwidth to be optimal. We forget when we're at CES or at a demonstration that the platform is in its optimal state. It has all the tech, all the bandwidth, all the power that it needs to work very well. But then when you go to someone's home, maybe they have fiber laid out in their town and they have high-speed internet. Maybe not. Maybe Google got to their town and wired them all up. Maybe not. Right? And so now that experience is not the same by any stretch of the imagination. And so there has to be an investment in infrastructure to basically make 5G available everywhere. That's a choice.
Well, on that note, I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap it because we're out of time. And I'd love to get at some point you back on the air to talk about interactive television because I think it's we're at a very big inflection point with that. And again, I was very surprised that nothing about interactive television was said at CES. I think it was a big mistake on CES's part, and again on the smart TV set makers' part. But that's for another time. If you want to know more about, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was going to say I used to say that interactive TV is called a video game, but I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I do think they also set them with video games too, because we're now starting to see video games from a TV set where you use a controller, not a big console. And you will see more about that, I think, as time goes on. If you want more details about Melba's company and the interesting research they're doing, here's where you go online, www.reach3insights.com. That's www.reach3insights.com. I think you'll find it very interesting viewing and reading. Melba, good night. Ahead of Media Entertainment for Reach3. Thank you again for joining us. Pleasure to have you on this half hour. Let's have you back soon.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
You're welcome, Melba. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Melba Benoit, or Melba Benoit from Reach 3 Insights, joining us live from Valencia, California in Los Angeles. Before we leave you, our classic trivia question of the week, who hosted Double Dare 2000 in 2000? Who hosted Double Dare 2000 in 2000? If you're first with the correct answer, you win the wonderful book, Identify Yourself, by the creator of Night Flight back in USA Network in the 80s, Stuart S. Shapiro. If you know the answer, email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. That's simonapple04@yahoo.com. Don't forget to enclose your name and where you're emailing from. First correct answer, you win. And if you missed the question, we'll post it over the weekend on Facebook and on Twitter at UBC Simon TWBT. That's the UBC Simon TWBT. Remember, you want to win, you got to be in. So do so, and all the greatest. Thanks to all of our guests, Melvin Benoit, Craig Brooks, and of course, Frank D'Onofrio, for being with us this Friday afternoon. Monday and tomorrow, we tell live from the new series, Seven Worlds, One Planet, simulcasting next weekend on AMC, IFC, Sundance TV, and BBC America. Executive producer, Johnny Keeley. He's in New York on Monday. We'll have him as our lead guest live. If you came in late on today's program, you want to catch up on episodes you missed, go to the homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. That's where you can get all of our episodes from 2019 and earlier. And remember, we're available all weekend on podcasts at iTunes, Apple TV, Speaker Podcast app, and also on the iHeartRadio Podcast Network at www.iHeartRadio.com. What do you think about our show today? What's your thoughts on where TV is at and where it's going? About Elvis Presley's birthday and his role with television? Love to hear from you, so email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. Find me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, UBC Simon TWBT. We love hearing from you. I respond within 24 hours, however you make your move. How? Because what you say matters, now more than ever. The views expressed in this program are those of the participants. Now, so is the Blog Talk Radio speaker and iHeartRadio. Our director associate Blog Talk Radio is Candace Williams. Andy Toe is Blog Talk Radio's general manager. Jay Sonnenberg is executive content producer. And the co-founders of Blog Talk Radio are Alan Levy and Bob Cherish. Tomorrow Be Televised is brought to you by Audible.com and Amazon Company. Remember, Audible transformed the way you hear the world. For a trio of great audiobooks, great gift to start, or great wonderful gift to start the year or the decade on, audibletrial.com/televised. But Tomorrow Be Televised, I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Thank you for listening. A fantastic weekend. We are back on Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, you know where, Blog Talk Radio Speaker and the iRadio Podcast Network. If you like what you heard, tell a friend, be interactive with us, and whatever you're up to this weekend, please make it safe and make it great. Until the next time, stay well and stay tuned.